I want to pass on service the instruments. You call the company to find out information. I repair it down to the board level. Back to you. I'm signing. K6DPC clear.
Bye-bye, Hal. Thank you for your information. So, to get back, Joe, getting proper feeding of the driven element and get properly resonated in the middle of that Yagi, relatively easy. You've done that. To find the right frequency of resonance of each of the directors, very difficult. And therefore, you don't do it. When you're tuning a Yagi on a real good richeometry antenna range, you're doing perturbation theory. You're holding a small testing tool, which is a long, thin piece of wood where you're standing out of the field. At the end of your long piece of wood, you've got a small piece of copper foil, and you're holding that piece of copper foil near the tip of a particular director. When you do that, you're adding capacitance to the director. You're loading it. You're tuning it to a low wear frequency. And while you do that, you watch the gain and you watch the biswa and you see what happens. And therefore, you know what will happen if you had made that element longer. Because electronically, you're making it longer, even though physically you didn't do it. And if you, for some reason, don't have faith in that procedure, which works like a charm, you can put telescoping tubing at the tip of the element and make the tubing go longer and shorter. But by perturbation theory, you find out what length Mother Nature wants that element to be to give maximum gain or maximum front-to-back performance of that particular Yagi. Correspondingly, let me drop. On the end of your test tool, you hold a fairly large piece of copper foil, and you hold it in the vicinity of the center of the director. That cancels some of the local magnetic field, which tunes the antenna director to a higher frequency. So holding a piece of metal near the center tunes it to a higher frequency. Holding a piece of metal near the tip tunes it to a lower frequency. And you do that with each one of the directors, and you very rapidly on a good antenna range will find out what that antenna wants to be in order to give higher performance on your particular frequency. So indirectly, you're measuring the ideal resonant frequency for each of those directors. But to do it directly, I'll admit it's a very difficult problem. We got to move on, Joe. Good question. Craig, KD2, CXK. I think it's KD2. What would you like to talk about tonight? And how many weeks from now will the next session of your astronomy net be? KD2 CXK, K2LIW. You got it, Craig.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, Matt. Okay, let's see. Let's go in reverse order. This Thursday coming up, I think, is the next installment of the Astronomy Net. I hope everybody to attend. It starts at 8:30, and we try and keep it around 2 hours. I want to back up to the first question quickly about mining on the moon, what's on the moon that's not on Earth, and that is what appears to be an abundance of helium-3, which is used in nuclear fusion and other experiments. So that's something to think about. And it's very expensive and very rare on Earth. Okay, my TechNet question I guess it could be a little fun. I'd like to know the differences, the explanation and the principles of Doppler, RDF, and transmitter hunting. What is the best, would be the most efficient means of finding a transmitter, whether it be hidden or moving, and how does Doppler work, and how is it used? KD2 CXK, back to net.
Quick comment. In the case of Doppler, fox hunting, there are Dopplers and there are Dopplers. To homebrew a Doppler-type direction-finding fox hunting receiver, in my opinion, is very difficult. The total number of guys who have got a really clean operating Doppler system is an extremely small percentage. There's a zillion ways the Doppler homebrewed can be made almost inoperative. You're going to have 4, 6, 8, some number of individual monopole-like antennas set up in a quasi-circular pattern, usually mounted on the top of the vehicle that's doing the fox hunting. And by diode switching arrangements, you're cyclically going through each one of those antennas, usually in a clockwise manner, but it could go in a clockwise, counterclockwise manner. But you're going through them cyclically, and you're going through the whole cycle something like 400 or 600 times per second. You can't do that with electromechanical relays. They don't move fast enough, and they just don't move fast enough. Let me drop. So you're doing it with pin diode-like structure. But now, the pin diodes that you're turning on and off are in the very delicate front end of that receiver, and they are making spikes of noise. And those spikes of noise can desensitize the receiver, something fierce. So the Doppler technique on paper is a beautiful technique, but the way you carry it out really separates the men from the boys. And the number of guys who've got a good, clean, sensitive lobe intimod distortion Doppler switching network for that kind of a radio direction finding antenna, very few have got one of those. And when you do, even then, it requires quite a bit of human intervention to properly interpret the results. The Doppler system will say that the signal arriving to the north right now is the strongest of all those signals that are out there. But as you drive your vehicle, and as you move your vehicle, and you're getting knolls and peaks and valleys of the multi-path antenna signals coming to your vehicle, and some of them are bouncing off the floor, off the road, off the water towers, off the buildings, off the trees, off the telephone poles, signals are bouncing all over the place, and as you move your vehicle, those individual signals are shifting in amplitude, shifting in phase, and all of the signals come together as a voltage vector sum at your particular receiving antenna. And so there are periods of time when you move your vehicle 1 foot, and the main signal coming to you from the front, from the north, which was 10 dB above threshold, suddenly becomes 20 dB below threshold because you've moved 1 foot. And so the electronics is now going to be indicating the direction of maximum signal strength, and while you're watching that display, it's bouncing all over the place. Let me drop. Therefore, even with a properly operating Doppler receiving system while doing fox hunting, it takes a kind of mental integration. You have to make sure that you are not the driver. You are the second or third passenger in that vehicle studying that display, and now you have to use mental integration. You'll say that, 85% of the time the maximum signal was coming from the north, 20% of the time the signal was coming from the west, 10% of the time the signal was coming from the east, but those are probably reflections of buildings because on average they're intermittent and weaker, but the strongest signal most of the time was from the front, from the north. Most likely that particular guy we're looking for is due north of us. Let's go in that direction. It takes that kind of mental integration. It takes a whole lot of training to properly use Doppler scanning. The other technique that people have used is just look at signal strength, inverse square law. In theory, as you get closer to the source, the signal gets stronger. And so by going in various directions and keeping track of signal strength, and sometimes to make sure your receiver is not saturated, let me drop. To really do it right requires a well-shielded step attenuator in front of the receiver, particularly when you get close, in order to be able to set the signal to a weaker signal strength, which doesn't saturate your signal strength meter on the receiver. And if you're really going to be sophisticated, you're going to be using a voltage-to-frequency converter. You're going to be listening to a series of tones that represent signal strength as you drive. And now, with proper training, you recognize those pitches of those tones, and you know when you're going in the right direction. That's what I have to do when I'm trying to aim my high-gain antenna. I have at times used an antenna on 432, on 16 Yagis that had 5.5 degrees of beamwidth, and when you're swishing the antenna back and forth while listening to a single sideband signal, and his amplitude is jumping up and down, and as the signal that you're swishing with the azimuth aiming of your antenna is going up and down because it's going to the side lobes and the nose and eventually the main lobe of the antenna, to choose the right direction to aim the antenna to really be aimed back at that sideband signal, it requires training to do that. And what I've discovered is the right way to do it is to set the RF gain control so low that the guy's peaks of his voice are only slightly above threshold as you switch the antenna back and forth, and now very rapidly, without looking at the signal strength meter, just looking at the direction indicator for the antenna and listening to what your ear has heard over a period of time, you very rapidly figure out what's the right direction to aim the antenna. So there's a learning curve in finding the right direction of arrival from a fixed station. There's a learning curve, a particularly large learning curve, to do fox hunting and to figure out whether or not you're moving the vehicle in the right direction to go toward the fox. There's a whole whole lot to this that doesn't meet the eye at first, if you know what I mean, Craig. There's a lot to it. By the way, that beautiful when he dropped... On USQRZ.com website, you've got this beautiful picture of the surrounding terrain around your house. And I think I'm seeing one of the elements of your antenna in the foreground. Was that taken from the top of your tower? Beautiful looking picture. KD2CXK, K2RIW in the thick, man.
K2RIW, KD2CXK. No, it was not taken from the top of my tower. Dick, I'm going to make you even more jealous than that. That's my bedroom window view and my hand shack. I live in an apartment building, so I'm glad you enjoy that. Okay, so I understand that there's a large learning curve here when it comes to RDF, especially when it comes to interpreting Doppler results. And let's say if you were looking for a fox, per se, and you were well-skilled, which do you think is a better system? What do you think is going to give you better results in an urban environment? And I think that may be a little bit of a catalyst there, but I'm interested in hearing which you would prefer, a Doppler system or or let's say if you had a Yagi that was on a rotator or something like that and you wanted to find a transmitter that way. KD2CXK, back to net.
When it comes to the guys who have successfully done fox hunting, there have been from time to time side-by-side comparisons with a guy doing amplitude comparison versus Doppler scanning. And quite often the guys doing just amplitude comparison will find the fox in, let's say, 1 hour. And quite often the guys who are skilled using a dot scan system will find the fox in 10 minutes. So the past history is that a good operating... Let me drop... I think that was Bill AC2IS. You're going to be after Wes. If you've got a well-operating DOPS system with a well-trained operator, boy, sometimes he can go straight to the fox real fast. So that the experience seems to say that DOPS scanning is the right way to go, even in a urban environment. Now, in an urban environment, when a whole lot of signals are bouncing between those marble canyons, life gets a lot more complicated, and that particular operator better be a lot more skilled. Because the DOP scan system is sensitive to back lobes and side lobes and multipath at each instant of time, and a well-tuned Yagi has only a main lobe and all the other lobes are real weak. If this is the best of all worlds, let me drop.
Quick question, Dave.
There's a QAX article about that.
Okay. I heard Barry, and there's a whole list of people who are going to be giving us questions on this. If this is the best of all worlds, you'd have a 3, 4, or 5 element Yagi mounted on the roof of a large station wagon vehicle. The Yagi would be rotating rapidly, like 1 revolution per second. You make sure you're not standing near human beings. You've got it mounted high enough that it's not whipping people in the eye that are standing alongside of the vehicle. But that Yagi, with its very clean pattern, with a real rotary joint that can tolerate it, is swishing in a circular manner 1 revolution per second or 2, and now that properly displayed, that would be the most ideal direction-finding system. Nobody has done that. There's a whole lot of reasons why that is very darn difficult. So fox hunting itself is a hell of a lot of art and science to it. Wes, do you have a brief question on this particular subject? In 2XJN, K2LIW?
One on the antenna that you discussed, if let's say you would like to find the magnetic component of electromagnetic field, on the left-hand side of the first director of the Yagi, how would you do that? Also, in addition to what was said before about moon geology, gadolinium and terbium, and plenty of material that is used in televisions, hybrid card batteries, and plenty of other things, that's what Romney was actually having in mind when was trying to get to the power, because he really wanted to go to the moon mining. Get to it here.
Wes, your comments were not on the subject that's on the floor right now. We can go back to that later. AC2IS, Do you have a question on this particular subject? Go ahead, Bill.
Wondering if the person asking the question about doppel scanning is asking about doppel scanner operation, which seems like mostly what you were talking about, or if he was asking more about the internal implementation, and if so, I'd like to take a crack at explaining that.
Bill, your audio is extremely low. Your signal is quite weak. I'm hearing you because I'm wearing earphones. I think most other people are going to have trouble hearing you. But the question was, well, are we talking about the inner construction of a Doppler scan, or are we talking about its method of operation, or are we talking about how to train a person for properly using it? And depending on how the person who asked the original question was posing it, you really need all three pieces of information. Doppler scanning, fox hunting, only works well if you understood the theory of operation when you're building it, properly built it, and got rid of all of the minefield that really is there, and then have a whole lot of training on using it. Once you put that all together, those DopScan people can find the fox in 10 minutes when everyone else is taking more than an hour, is the experience. But the swishable Yagi, I think, would be even better. I know that Barry had a question on this one, or a comment. N2MB, wonder how much fox hunting you've done, Barry. N2MB, K2LIW.
Well, from this question, you're probably going to figure out not too much. What happens if the fox is horizontally polarized, maybe even using a dipole instead of a vertical? How does the Doppler, do these Doppler things have any way of determining whether the signal coming in is horizontal or vertical?
Barry, you've asked a nice, pure question. Mother Nature is not that simple. The best answer I can give you, off to one side, so to speak, is that for a solid year and a half, every single weekend I used to drive up to Utica, New York, using both a horizontally polarized loop antenna on the top of my car, a square loop antenna, as well as a vertical whip antenna. And by way of a relay inside the car, when doing 2 meter single sideband, while talking to that guy in southern New Jersey that you and I both know very well, K2, can't think of his name right now, call letters, a guy with a couple of 2 meter, four Yagis on top of 100 feet of tower in southern New Jersey, single sideband, he and I would talk 200 miles continuously as I drove my vehicle up the New York State Thruway, through Albany, and then over to Utica on Route 90. And we talked continuously over the 200-mile path, sideband. When I would flip back and forth between horizontal and vertical, and he's using highly tuned, horizontally polarized, moon-bounce-capable 2-meter Yagis, four of them, on the top of on top of 100 feet of tower in southern New Jersey. As I flip back and forth between horizontal and vertical, when I'm in the canyons of the New York Thruway, 98% of the time, whether I listen to him horizontal or listen to him with vertical polarization in my vehicle, it made no difference. Let me drop. By the time that signal sifted through 200 miles of stuff, trees and water towers and buildings and roads and hills and valleys and everything else, by the time that signal got to me, it had no clearly defined polarization. If I listened horizontal, if I listened vertical, he sounded the same. When I got up to a scenic overlook where I could now look for 20 or 30 miles, yes, the horizontal polarization had an advantage. He was louder on horizontal and vertical when I'm at a scenic overlook. But when I'm really doing the driving through the marble canyons, it made no difference. As such, that signal, when it's bouncing in that environment off of every single object that's there, You hold your handy talkie in the room with you right now, and you squeeze the handle on that, and you think a vertically polarized signal is coming out of that rubber duck and going to that repeater that you're now talking to, so to speak. Absolutely not. Look at all the things in that room with you. Every one of those metallic objects is reflecting a signal. Every one of those non-metallic objects, even the wooden table, is reflecting a slightly weaker signal. And some of those compound bounces are making that vertical signal coming out of your rubber duck become horizontal when it leaves. When I'm listening to this particular repeater with my handy talkie in my bathroom in Huntington, I have to set the handy talkie horizontal on a plastic shelf in order to get the strongest signal. I don't get the strongest signal vertical in my bathroom. You see what's going on here, Barry? by the time you get into the real world of multipath, unless you've got an extremely short direct line of sight path, polarization is very different than what you think. And two moonbounds, K2LIW, I wonder if any of that's a surprise.
Actually, I've noticed the very same thing. I totally agree with you. My kind of question is a little skewed, just like the polarization. When you're trying to track a signal, when you're looking at somebody with your Doppler scanner on the roof of your car, I assume that's where they put them, with a bunch of vertical antennas, and the signal that you're looking for is, in fact, horizontal, that Doppler is going to pick up two signals, and the one directly in front of you is going to be a null. Usually that's the way I see it. And so how does the Doppler radar determine whether it's a horizontal or vertical signal coming in so that you could eventually get up to the sky and find them?
In any real environment, Barry, no matter what he transmits, the polarization you get is different 99% of the time. He may be transmitting a pure vertical signal, and at this instant in time, you're going to get a signal that's tilted 87 degrees to the right of vertical, if you know what I mean. The DOP scan itself, because the signal in an urban environment, the signal you see on the display of a DOP scan from your moving vehicle is bouncing all over the place, and you have to use mental integration to figure out what's the real direction of arrival. Now, that bouncing all over the place, is it really because of nulling of co-polarized signals off of the multipath environment? Or is the nulling sometimes happening because of cross-polarization of the reception? The answer is yes to all of the above. It's all going on at once. And so you could, if you want to, make all the individual elements of the DOP scan circular polarized. You could make them axial mode helical antennas so that they're circular polarized, so therefore the exact polarization of reception would be somewhat wiped out, so to speak. You could build a DOP scan that way. I think the improvement in performance would be less than all the effort is worth. I think the improvement would be very small, and there's a whole lot of other crazy characteristics you would experience because of a circular polarization. Let me drop. When a circular polarized signal bounces off a road, for instance, a flat surface at a grazing angle, the clockwise circular polarized transmitting signal becomes counterclockwise after the bounce. Now you're getting a multipath of a clockwise direct signal and a counterclockwise bounce signal, and when you mix the two together, if the amplitudes were the same, you end up linear. And you're about to ask, what's linear? Horizontal vertical, or slant 45 right, or slant 45 left? And the answer is yes, 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 and yes. Depending on the phase angle and the exact delay of the clockwise signal and the counterclockwise signal, they mix together making you a linear, and that linear can be any polarization in the world. So even if you were using a circular polarized receiving antenna on your DOP scan, because of that crazy characteristic, you'd still be in trouble. There's no simple solution to this one. This is a toughie. You see what you're up against here. There's definite conservation of misery here, Barry. N2MB, K2LIW.
This is Thomas.
Okay. I'm glad I asked him. That was a cool question. And I got a good answer. Thanks, Dick. Back to you. N2 Mike Bravo, Rockaway.
No charge for that one. W2NDZ, Whiskey 2. It sounded like November Delta Zulu. Correct me on your call letters. Give us your name, sir, and then proceed with your question or comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, it's Neil, Whiskey 2, November Delta Golf. I just want to comment. I know the non-Doppler people who are out hunting will take about, I think you said, 20, 25 minutes longer to find the target. You know that we have a local transmitter hunting club, and the members of that club, any of them listening, can attest to the fact that we have members that frequently are second and third place, and a couple of times have been first, just beating veterans of the activity without a Doppler. And the method was published in the Feinmark blog. That was like last year or the year before. But my wife and I have perfected the method using a receiver with a very wide RF gain
know, Neil, and like all of ham radio, as a beginner, you think you better have a gold-plated, the world's best transmitter and receiver when you buy your first one. Not necessarily true. People think when they're going to be doing a fox hunting, you better have the best of all equipment. And your very first antenna when you set up ham radio better be a fantastic high-performance antenna. Absolutely not. There's many a guy who begins, his first antenna is made out of coat hanger wire. His first radio was bounced down a set of stairs. He bought it used at a flea market. He's the third owner. The front panel is dented, but it works. You can start off very simple. When you're doing fox hunting, when you're getting the ham radio, when you're setting up your tower, your antenna, whatever. So don't let the sophisticated equipment discourage you. Give it a try. Join your buddies. The best way to do fox hunting is to do it with somebody who has done it before, as an apprentice, if you know what I mean. It's a fun thing to do. On your QRZ.site, you got this beautiful golden tabby cat. I'm a cat lover. What's his name, Neil? Go ahead.
N-O-R-I. He weighs 23 pounds, and he thinks he's a dog. But he's, 23 pounds, he's not heavy, he's just huge. 100% in agreement, Dick. We just moved to a new place here. I threw a wire into my attic, literally. Threw it so that it was straight across one end of the attic to the other. And had several contacts with that antenna today in Slovenia using 5 watts. So, no, you tell me sophisticated equipment. I do have a question for you outside of all of this, and I'm never here at the start of the net to throw my pulse right in, but if you have time tonight, you can call me back and I will ask you my question.
Very fine, Neil. I've got you on the list, and we're going to go a little bit more rapidly now because this is the so-called question and answer period before the mailbag, and we're running a little bit late. So you're allowed to ask your question on DopScan as many times as you want to in the future, Craig. It's a good one, and it's something that we definitely need in this particular repeater among many other repeaters. The next person on the list was John, KD2, Foxtrot, Quebec uniform. Go right ahead with your question or comment, John. K2RIW and the Tech Man. Okay, I think John is not there. I'm going to go to Ed next. K2, Golf Juliet Echo. Go right ahead, Ed. K2RIW and the Tech Man. Okay, Ed's not there. We're more than late enough to go to the mailbag. So, John, what kind of fantastic questions have you gotten this week? KC2WGB, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. Yes, have a good question here from Ed. I'll let me let it drop. Ed is looking to measure very accurately QRP power with a wattmeter. What he wants to calibrate his wattmeter. What he would like to do is make an arrangement with a resistor, maybe a thermistor, thermometer, and do some actual calculations. Maybe you could help him out on how to do that, proceed with that, and also mention the calorimetry with maybe elevating the temperature of water, whatever could help him out. And he's interested 1 to 10 watts. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah. 1 to 10 watts. I've done that in the past by setting up a 50-ohm resistor made out of Allen Bradley resistors. I think I had a pair of 100-ohm resistors in parallel or 5 10-ohm resistors in series. Some way I made up a resistor that had low enough stray inductance at my particular operating frequency, which was 50 megacycles. As long as you build it with short enough lead lens and the right kind of a physical layout, you can be reasonably assured you've got a 50-ohm resistor that has very little stray inductance and stray capacitance. When in doubt, if you can get a hold of a real 50-ohm dummy load, one that's rated for 1 to 10 watts, that would be a slightly better approach. Let me drop. Then by building a shielded box around that 50-ohm resistor and setting up something like a germanium diode and or silicon diode to rectify the voltage that's directly across that resistor, put it into a filter capacitor, capacitor can be a 001 disc ceramic capacitor, and that in turn, with a small load resistor, the load resistor could be something like a 10 kilo ohm resistor across the 001, that goes into a high impedance voltmeter, a modern day digital voltmeter that's got 10 mega ohm input impedance, or an old fashioned vacuum tube voltmeter that has 11 mega ohm input impedance. You're not going to put it into a triplet or a simplet volt ohm milliammeter. You're not going to use that. Triplet volt ohm, what do we call it? VOM, volt ohm milliammeter. You're going to be using a real high impedance digital voltmeter or a vacuum tube voltmeter. Now, calibrating it is a little bit spooky. When you get up to numbers like 2 watts and above, if you calculate the peak voltage that's there, and you know that because you're using a germanium diode, you're getting 2/10 of a volt drop, or a silicon diode, you're getting something like 6/10 of a volt drop, and you do a compensation for the voltage drop across the diode. Let me drop. You can come up with an anticipation of how many rectified volts are going into your digital voltmeter versus power going into the resistor. I did that way back in the dark ages of the early 1960s. And when I finally got around to calibrating it, I vaguely remember that where I thought was 10 watts was really 9.5, and what I thought was 2 watts was really 2.25 watts. It was in the right ballpark. And because I was using it as a relative power indicating device, I was tuning up a transistorized transmitter that I was building at that time, homebrew transmitter. It told me when I was going in the right direction to get more power. And the fact that my exact power had, let me pick a number, 10% of error, or 15% of error, didn't really affect me very much. The only place where this diode rectifier approach gives you some grief, as you start getting to lower and lower amounts of power, to where the peak voltage coming out of your transmitter is now getting close to the so-called striking voltage of your diode. If you're getting down to 3/10 of a volt on a germanium diode, and you're getting down to 7/10 of a volt on a silicon diode, now the voltage drop is starting to give you a bigger error component. There are ways around that. You can now forward bias the diode with a half mega ohm resistor and make a slightly different network that is much more sensitive for smaller voltages. So there are ways around that. Now, rectifying the voltage and making an interpretation as to what power that means on a 50 ohm resistor, let me drop, is, in my opinion, one of the easiest ways to go. And since most instrumentation and transmission lines, your transmission lines have a high probability of being 50 ohms, your antenna has a high probability of being 50 ohms, therefore when you're building a 1 to 10 watt transmitter, you probably want it to work correctly into a 50 ohm load. Therefore the 50 ohm terminating resistor is the right way to go, and rectifying that voltage and making an interpretation is relatively simple. To go the other way around with calorimetry, to know that now a certain number of watts into that resistor is going to create a certain number of joules of energy per second. You've got a couple of problems there. You've got a great big time constant. How long do you wait in order to get an answer? I mean, your 50 ohm resistor may have a thermal time constant of 30 seconds. Does that mean you're always going to be running the transmitter for 30 solid seconds before you come up with an answer as to whether or not it's putting out 3 watts versus 4 watts right now? And if you're doing a tuning procedure where the power is slowly creeping up as the resistor is heating up via indicated power by measuring temperature with a thermistor, it's slowly increasing. At the same time, you're operating the controls that are making the real power going up and down, and you may not be able to resolve that. The diode rectifier network gives you an answer in a small fraction of a second, and it has very little settling time. The thermal technique has got a huge settling time and a bunch of other errors. I wouldn't say it's not the right way to go. Many of the power meters that we buy are thermal sensing devices. Let me drop. The old Hewlett-Packard, I can't think of the model number right now, a true RMS watt meter, really was thermal. And it had a time constant of a couple of seconds. The reason had a time constant of a couple of seconds is that it was done with micro-miniature devices. In other words, the actual resistor and thermistor sensing and whatever in there, it's inside of your bolometer, your thermal sensing power meter head, you'd have to look at it with a microscope, and for you to homebrew something like that is very, very difficult. With reasonable, and by the way, that thermistor head on the power meter from Hewlett-Packard that's got a couple of second time constant, you hit it with more than a tenth of a watt, and there's a chance you're going to burn it out. So to be 1 to 10 watts power sensitive simultaneously with home brew, you're sort of forced into the voltage measurement technique. I wouldn't go thermal, is my opinion. Other people would try other techniques. On the surplus market, sometimes you can buy relatively inexpensive power meters. But most of the power meters you can buy are made for the milliwatt level. Therefore, you need a set... Let me drop... You need a set of 10-watt rated attenuators, 10 dB and a 20 dB attenuator, to be put in front of the power meter that you can buy and to measure the power level without burning out the meter. So it's a little bit difficult. I think voltage rectification, I've done it that way. I didn't get answers that were perfect, but they were good enough for what I was doing. That's one particular recommendation. Drag your feet as I pass it back to you, John. Maybe somebody's got an alternate solution for home brewing, a power meter. KC2WGB with a little delay. K2RIW in the TechNet. Eric, how would you do it? KE2EJ, and give us as much audio as you can. Eric, you're a little bit low.
All right, you can do it colorimetrically. I mean, I do tens of kilowatts colorimetrically, but you can also do it at the 1 to 10 watt level. I read what the guy was asking. He was asking a non-inductive resistor and some kind of thermocouple temperature device. That's not the way you would go. You'd use a calibrated, an accurate non-inductive 50-ohm resistor, which is immersed in water, and there's a whole series of formulas that you can use to measure the raise in temperature and calculate the actual amount of power that's being dissipated. The formula actually takes into consideration the volume of water that's being used to raise, that you're using to raise the temperature by 1 degree. The lower the power, the longer it takes, the smaller the volume you want to use. It's not practical at very low levels, but anyway, his original question is really calibrating a meter. And the best answer is to borrow a thermocouple power meter like I have, calibrate your meter, and then be done with it. He wasn't actually talking about using that meter as an operating device. He was calibrating another meter to it. So, your voltage method is a wonderful way to do it, and it's probably best for the experiment to do it like that. But you could do it calorimetrically, but it's a real pain, and just doing the calculations is a lot of fun, too. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, the calorimetry technique is used by sophisticated equipment. Hewlett-Packard made for a number of years a great big fancy high-power watt meter that I think ran up to the 10-watt level. And at the 10-watt level, it circulated oil through the terminating resistor at a known rate of gallons per hour and measured the delta in temperature of the oil going in and the oil coming out of the terminating resistor region. And knowing the rate of oil and the specific heat of the oil and whatever, there's a way you can figure out exactly how many watts, and it was a meter probably accurate to the nearest 1% or so. And then by way of directional couplers, Hewlett-Packard, among other companies, have made meters that go to the kilowatt, multi-kilowatt level by taking a small sample of that power and putting it into a calorimetry-like oil flow measurement system. But to homebrew that is difficult. And I'm assuming the guy that's writing the question to John is thinking about homebrewing, but if he has access to somebody's test equipment that he can borrow, or bring Mohammed to the mountain, so to speak, or bring your test equipment to the place that owns the good instrument, and then you can do a side-by-side comparison, that could be a lot of fun, and you run a calibration chart, so to speak. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Now, by the way, Dick, the meter that I use for tens of kilowatts, if you put more than plus 10 dBm in it, you blow it up. So, you're relying on the directional coupler to, do your attenuation.
Yeah, you're relying on, you're relying
relying on precision directional couplers and precision attenuators after them going into your actual power sensing head. So there's a whole step-by-step procedure to find out what's the error tolerance of each one of those components in that chain.
Each head has a calibration scale on it, so you can compensate. And of course, you punch in the offset of attenuation and it gives you real watts output.
Yeah, I own one of these high-power heads that's good for a couple of watts at least. I forget how many watts. But the actual terminating attenuator with its fins on it that dissipates the heat, it is married to a particular bolometer, a power sensor, and the two as a married pair have a calibration curve. And so you don't want to mix and match those. They're built-in married sets. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
TC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Also, I'd like to mention when they're saying non-inductive resistors, do not use a carbon resistor because that has a negative temperature coefficient. If you're measuring anything decent and you warm it up, it's going to change in value. I have another question from Ed. Ed, he would like to know, you described a capacitor with a diode. Could you give him a little more description on that so he has an exact configuration for it?
Hey, you must be looking at the chat room, I'm guessing, and getting feedback right away. Your terminating resistor, one end of it is grounded to the case of the shielded structure. The other lead is the hot lead coming in with a coaxial connector, maybe a short length of coax cable. From that junction of input coax cable and terminating resistor, at that exact same junction, you put a, let me pick the number, you put the anode of a diode. The cathode of the diode now goes to a capacitor to ground. From that junction of cathode of diode and capacitor, you put another resistor across it to ground to discharge it at a reasonable rate, and probably a 10K resistor would be the right number, 10K, 20K resistor. That junction of 20K resistor to ground and the capacitor to ground and the cathode of the diode, that junction is the point where you measure your voltage with your digital voltmeter. And maybe you want to put another 1K resistor there going to the digital voltmeter, which goes to a terminal on the outside of the box, and that 1K resistor is just acting as a poor man's RF choke so that the direct RF doesn't get coupled back out of that connector out of the box to your digital voltmeter. So once again, the schematic is 50 ohm resistor to ground, anode of diode is at that point, cathode of diode is a 001 capacitor to ground, and also across that capacitor is the 20K discharge resistor. From that upper junction that I just described, an ungrounded junction, a 1K resistor going to the output voltage sensing device. Now, that meter will have a rather pretty repeater.
Time out.
That arrangement that I just described will have a very predictable voltage output versus power input. But there's a little bit of a catch. You now have to worry about, are you measuring one exact frequency? If you're building a 3.5 megacycle transmitter, and if nothing but 3.5 megacycles is there, there's a pretty exact relationship between voltage and power, rectified voltage and power. If your particular transmitter happens to be putting out the desirable 3.5 megacycles simultaneous with some second harmonic of 7.0 megacycles, and as you're adjusting the controls on the transmitter, the ratio of second harmonic to primary is changing, at the same time the power output is changing, then life can get kind of complicated. What the meter reads and what the real power is could differ by an awful lot. So that's the one vulnerability of this kind of a network. It is it's looking at peak voltage that the diode sees and whether or not the second harmonic is in phase with the fundamental or out of phase, depending on how you set the controls. Some confusion could take place. When in doubt, building yourself a bandpass filter to make sure you're only measuring the desired frequency would be another thing to consider. KC2, WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, WGB. Very good. Okay, I'll move on to the next one. You let it drop. It's a question from a gentleman named Joe. He has a 50-volt generator that he runs, DC. It has a 50-milliamp shunt. He has a 50 millivolt meter on it, which indicates his amperage. He has a second one. He wants to know if he can put that one in parallel on that shunt. He needs it for remote reading. Will that affect the accuracy by much? So take it from there, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, run the schematic by one more time. Power supply I'm going to call is a 15-volt DC generator. A 50-milliamp shunt. Okay. He may have the right resistor such that when 50 volts is across the resistor, exactly 50 milliamps flows, a 1K resistor would do that. That in turn goes to a milliamp meter that measures 1 milliamp, and it says, yes, we now have 50 volts. But there's a catch. The 1 milliamp meter, depending on how it's generated, how it's designed, the 1 milliamp meter may have an internal impedance of 1,000 ohms. So now, 1,000 ohm of the movement of the meter in series with a 1K resistor that's now trying to measure current could give you some errors. So what's really required here, because you're now getting into a kind of combination of series and parallel resistors, you have to, one means or another, discover what is the real internal impedance of the meter movement itself. Let me drop.
Let me give you a correction, Dick.
Yeah, but even if that's not exactly what he's talking about, for the general purpose of other people, you have to know what is the internal impedance of your meter movement in order to know really what's happening. There is a whole interesting test procedure for measuring the internal impedance of a meter. I mean, if your particular meter has an internal impedance of, let me pick a number, 100 ohms, and if you think you're going to put that directly across your volt-ohm milliammeter in the ohm scale and measure that number of ohms, in some cases the answer is absolutely not. Your particular volt-ohm milliammeter on the times one scale may put an amount of current through the circuit under test that is way beyond the meter movement's capability. If you're testing a sensitive 50 microampere meter movement, and now you're going to be putting 20 milliamps through it, you're going to peg the needle so violently you're probably going to damage it. So doing a direct ohm measurement of the meter could be difficult. There is an indirect procedure which could be described. But back to you, Joe. John, KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, I know he means 50 millivolts. They don't make shunts in 50 microvolts or millivolt amps. It's 50 millivolt shunt, and it's a 100 amp shunt. What I would suggest, if the two meters are identical, I don't think that would be a problem. But he could disconnect one meter and connect the other meter, see if it reads exactly the same, if he has them matched. I believe he should be able to put them in parallel on that shunt. 50 millivolts is 50 millivolts. Those meters will measure the voltage. That's what I believe. Back to you, Dick.
I'm pretty sure I agree with you, John. However, to go the next step, the meter movement itself, with whatever series resistor or shunt resistor is internal to it, has a measurable amount of impedance. If this is the best of all worlds, every ammeter would have 0.0 ohms of internal resistance. Every voltmeter would have infinite number of ohms of impedance. Therefore, when you put the voltmeter across the source of voltage to be measured, it would create absolutely no load. And when you take that ideal ammeter, you put it in series with a circuit, there would be no voltage drop across it because it has 0 ohms. That's the ideal world. Every real world ammeter has some amount of series resistance, which sometimes makes a difference. Every real world voltmeter has some amount of impedance that's drawing some current out of the circuit. The power required to move that meter off the left-hand peg toward the right-hand peg, that power is coming from your circuit. And depending on how sensitive your meter is and whether or not there's an internal amplifier, in the case of a digital voltmeter or in case of a voltam, a vacuum tube voltmeter, there is a real amplifying device there that helps you along. But when it comes to purely passive meters, every real meter has got a resistance. And by one means or another, you can measure that resistance. Once you measure the resistance and you understand the rules of parallel and series resistors, you can now calculate exactly what you're going to get and exactly what change in measurements you're going to get when you hook up the second circuit to the first circuit. So it's really Ohm's law, if you know what I mean. You just have to recognize the fact that all meters have impedance. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Yes, that is very true. And they may react differently. But he just has to be careful because they are very sensitive. And I know he doesn't want to burn out. He only has those 2 meters. But, yeah, I think he'll just have to do a little research. And if he goes on their Simpson meters, they're good meters. If he goes on the web, he'll be able to tell if the internal part of the meter is basically the same. And he can make some very careful measurements, and I think he'll do well with that. Okay, let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one. All righty. Now we have a ham that has 2 directional couplers. They're both identical. He's working within the rated frequency. Now, what he wants to know, he has 2 10 dB couplers. He wants to totally put them in parallel. He wants to know if the sample port will now give him 5 dB, because 10 dB is not giving him enough information, so he wants to try paralleling the two of them with identical elbows and T's. All of the lengths will be the same. So what do you think on that? Maybe you can give him some better advice. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
A nice sounding attempt. I do not recommend it. Each directional coupler has a straight through line and a coupled line internal, which is another parallel line very close to the first straight through line. The straight through line, by definition, is a pure 50 ohm transmission line. Any attempt to put 2 directional couplers in parallel, you'll be putting a pair of 50 ohm transmission lines in parallel. Therefore, throughout your pair of meters, from left side where you've got the T connector to the right side where you've got the T connector, you now have a 25 ohm system of some number of wavelengths of length. That in turn is a significant perturbation to your 50 ohm transmission line where you're trying to make a measurement. So right there you've got a problem. Second of all, would the voltage coming out of the first meter, out of the directional coupler, out of the first coupler, and the voltage coming out of the second coupler be exactly the same voltage in phase? If everything was done just right, yes. And the amount of voltage you would get out of those directional couplers in parallel would be no change. If the first meter is giving you 1/10 of a volt at your operating frequency, and the second meter is giving you 1/10 of a volt, and those 2/10 of a volt are in parallel, you're now getting an output of 1/10 of a volt. No improvement. And is there a way that you can take the directional ports and put them in series when the straight through ports are in parallel? And the answer is no. Now, could you put the 2 meters in series with each other? The straight through line of one going into the straight through line of the other. And now could you take the voltage...
Repeater, time out.
And now could you take the voltage out of the first and somehow introduce it to the voltage of the second and have them add? And there's a very slim possibility the answer is yes, if and only if you have access to the internal 50-ohm terminating resistor of the second meter. And with just the right line length everywhere, you take the output of the first meter, go into the so-called termination port of the second meter, and then take the directional output, I said meter, I meant coupler, and take the directional coupler output of the second coupler, and now we can get twice the voltage, 60 mV increase. There's a slim chance the answer is yes, but you'd have to know an awful lot about what you're doing, internal phase length, operating frequency, line length, electrical summing of line length, and whatever. Very difficult. I don't recommend it. Not impossible, but stuff it into the back of your mind saying it's possible with great difficulty. Let me drop. So with his single 10 dB directional coupler, if he's not getting enough signal to operate on, the next best thing he can do is put an amplifier on that port. If he puts a 10 or a 20 dB or a 30 dB amplifier on the output of that port, it's a 50 ohm signal generator. That's giving you a signal that's 10 dB weaker than the main signal. Amplify it before it goes into your instrumentation, and now you can see everything you want to see. So the amplification approach is a much better approach. Trying to use the 2 meters simultaneously, I strongly do not recommend it. Not impossible, very difficult. There's only 3 different minefields there. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, yes, Dick, I agree with you. That could be a disaster. But interesting question. All right, let's go over to Paul on the space report. That's it from the mailbag, KC2WGB.
Thank you, John. And Paul, what has NASA been doing this week? What did I hear somebody mentioning Voyager recently? Somebody was mentioning Voyager. Super strong, super weak signals. I know that I was listening to what we discussed last week about Voyager, and it was on the subject of how many receiving antennas could you be using when listening to Voyager. And the answer literally is infinity for all practical purposes as far as human beings are concerned. That signal coming out of Voyager, 8 billion miles away, in theory I could draw a sphere with a radius of 8 billion miles, you and I could calculate with a good calculator how many square miles there are in that sphere and how many dipole antennas I could set up, or how many receiving antennas I could set up across that sphere. And for all practical purposes, that answer is infinity. One of the things that we all forget about, one last thing I'm going to say before I pass it over to you, Paul, let me drop, is that it's very easy to start first learning about radio circuits and say, here's a transmitter, over there is a receiver, the receiver is receiving the signal from this transmitter, and that receiving antenna is receiving it, and so, hey, I've got a direct path between the two, there just happens to be some air in between. Very easy to think that. Until you start getting into the exact numbers. Let's assume now that I've got a 100 watt, let me think now. If I put 100 watts into a 50 ohm resistor, let's put it the other way around. If I put 100 volts into a 50 ohm resistor, would draw by definition 2 amperes. 2 amperes times 100 volts is 200 watts. There we go. 200 watts into my 50 ohm antenna means I will be putting exactly 100 volts RMS into that antenna at 2 amperes. And X number of miles away, a good receiver of modern design can easily listen to 1 microvolt. So 1 microvolt is coming out of the receiving antenna, going into the receiver, X number of miles away. 100 volts went into the transmitting antenna in my backyard. What's the ratio of 1 microvolt to 100 volts? Answer is 100 million to 1. In voltage. And that's a good, clean, high signal-to-noise ratio transmitting circuit I just described. I put 100 volts into the transmitting antenna, and my receiving antenna receives 1 microvolt. 100 million to 1 ratio, that's 10 to the 8. Since power is a function of voltage squared, the power ratio is 10 to the 16.